We've been listening to The Hard Blues, which is a composition by Julius Hemphill, as recorded on his album Coon Business, which is a fairly new release, about 8 months or so old, on the Arista label. And Julius Hemphill was featured on alto saxophone. He's joining me in the studio right now and is in Philadelphia for a performance this weekend, sponsored by the New Foxhole Cafe. It's a festival of new black music, which begins this Friday evening with a group called Rue, a Philadelphia-based group, continues Saturday evening, July 24th, with Julius Hemphill. And the following weekend, there will also be two performances with a group called Image. Saturday evening, July 31st, Oliver Lake will be performing. There are two shows for each of these performances, both 9 and 11 o'clock. A little bit about Julius Hemphill before we begin. As I said, his most recent recording is on the Arista label, and his recording dates range in scope from an appearance with Kool and the Gang on one of their albums to an appearance with Anthony Braxton on one of his albums for Arista Records. He grew up in Texas and also worked with the black artist group BAG in St. Louis and with the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians in Chicago, the group kind of affiliated with or from out of which sprung the Art Ensemble of Chicago. He's recently been in New York directing multimedia performances there. Julius, welcome to Fresh Air.
Right, thank you.
And I'd like to start by talking about BAG, the Black Artists Group.
Oh, okay. That was a group that had its inception in St. Louis in about 1968. And the activities are of the members of the group covered the disciplines of music, theater, plastic art, dance, and it was kind of a collective effort in what we considered a vacuum, so to speak, you know.
So it was a kind of sharing of performance space and ideas?
Yeah, right. First, touching base on ideas. And gradually, we were fortunate in that a local program there received a grant from the local Danforth Foundation, matched by, I think, the Rockefeller Foundation, to do a program called the Inner City Arts Project, right? Members of the Black Artist Group happened to be selected to participate in that program. So that, in turn, provided us, you know, with working space. So we sort of had, once we got our heads together, so to speak, the working space suddenly materialized, you know, and that we were quite fortunate in that regard, you know.
Lester Bowie and Oliver Lake were also involved with that group. Are you still in touch with them? I noticed Oliver Lake's coming next Saturday to perform at the Foxhole.
Right. We are in touch rather frequently, particularly Oliver. Lester's been traveling with the Art Ensemble. I think he's coming to New York within the next few days. I think I last saw him in Texas, as a matter of fact. I was there in the winter and on the way from San Francisco. The Art Ensemble came through and visited for 90 minutes or so and continued.
You grew up in Texas, right?
Right, in Fort Worth, yeah.
Who did you listen to when you were growing up?
Well, I listened to quite a number of people. Rather inadvertently, because at the time the jukeboxes, you know, contained selections from some of the really pace setters, greatest artists that the country has, you know, produced. And for example, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday. Charlie Parker.
It's hard not to picture Charlie Parker coming out of a jukebox.
Well, that's a rather contemporary point of view. I mean, uh, this was like in 1948 or so, you know what I mean? And I didn't know it was Charlie Parker necessarily until later on, you know, but I knew who it was, you know. I mean, I knew the name all right enough, but that's all I knew. But by the same way that people, you know, hear various things on radio nowadays, or coming out of various places that recorded music, you know, is played, then it happened that that was music that was coming out, you know. And that's just a sketchy list of, you know, all the things. Some of the people, there were plenty of blues players, for example, T-Bone Walker, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, right, who I guess was in one of the premier gospel blues kind of singers, you know. Let's see, all sorts of music, you know. Al Hibbler, I mean, just quite a range of music, you know, powerful music, you know.
Your tone on Alta Sax reminds me somewhat of Ornette Coleman's tone, and I know he's from Texas too. Did you know each other, or is there?
Right.
It sounds silly to say there's something about Texas that should make a tone like that, so I won't say it.
Well, it might not be silly at all, because, you know, a lot of an involvement, I should say, like music, occurs on several different levels, and I guess any many other creative type endeavors, you know, wherein you can manifest influences directly, so to speak, or in a tangible sort of way, reflect environmental, you know, conditions, sounds, attitudes, whatnot, you know. So I don't think it's at all strange, you know. I think it's quite probable, in fact, you know what I mean.
When you were developing your style on alto, was it a kind of conscious looking for a certain kind of tone, or did the tone that you now have kind of naturally evolve when you were learning?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, at least in my case, because nobody sounds the same. As a matter of fact, people have to work arduously toward getting the same tone, so that they are featureless, so to speak, you know, or they all sound the same, you know, like Billy May's saxophone style, you know, requires some special effort, I'm sure, you know what I mean, although I've never tried it, but...
Wait, who is Billy May?
Billy May is an arranger, composer, some band leader, I suppose, on occasion, who is located for the most part on the West Coast, I believe, but a while back, I can recall thing that was quite popular by him called Myelene Baby, and it had this kind of bent, mouthed saxophone sound going on in it, you know. What I'm saying is that, as I said, you know, people sound differently on these instruments, and so if you like the way you sound, then you work to improve it, you know what I mean, because there is no matter how good you sound, you know, there's a way that you can be consistent at it, and so you develop the technique of being consistent at the way you sound, you know, whether that's the way you sound naturally, or whether that's the way that you contrive to sound, you know, because you can do that also.
Mm-hmm.
Much like singing, you can develop the techniques required in operatic singing, or you can hone your blues, you know, techniques up, you know. But whatever it is, you know, you can, as I say, work toward consistency at it, you know. So, I mean, that's my approach, you know.
Before you moved to St. Louis, I think, and I think, though, I don't know, before your heavy involvement with contemporary jazz, I know you played with a boogie band that included Cornell Dupree, who's now right. been a studio musician and also has at least one album out on his own. He's a guitarist.
Right,
was that your musical leaning at the time, more towards boogie and dance music than kind of serious jazz?
No, that wasn't exactly my leaning, but there were elements of that playing in that particular band and others like it that also elements of the kind of thing that I do much of the time, or some of the time anyway. So it wasn't, you know, so much of a difference, you know. And the format wasn't heavily top 20 or 40 oriented, you know. It wasn't really like that. Much of the material was blues oriented. It was popular, you know, Bobby Bland, Lloyd Price kind of thing. But within that, lots of times they were using the blues, you know, and there's just, you know, no limit to the flexibility, even though within, you know, even within that context. So it wasn't that remote, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And then the other thing was that it was some consistent work too, you know. And
do you have any albums that you recorded with that group?
No, that was just club and local type road band, you know, traveling around with the show. Somebody else, Joe Simon, was in that band also. And he's quite popular nowadays, you know. And I think Cornell Dupree at the time was about 17 or so. You know? He was really mean on a guitar, you know what I mean? So it was, you know, that was Joe Turner, right, sang, you know, came through and used that band. And so that was a lot of... there was a lot going on, you know, but...
And the piece we just listened to, Hard Blues, your composition, certainly is a... I mean, you know that you know blues when you when you listen to that. And I think it's a really great mix of contemporary jazz style and blues style.
Yeah, thank you. But it's all there, you know.
Can we move on to Chicago
sure.
and the AACM? Can you describe what kind of group that was? What the purposes it formed for were?
Well, I think the title suggests rather adequately, you know, what their aims were, you know, as a group in terms of. Sustaining again a consistent musical environment, you know.
I only gave the letters, not the title, so let me mention it.
Well, you said it, the Association for the Advancement of what?
Creative Musicians.
Creative Musicians. That was, I believe you said that a moment ago.
Yeah, well, I did.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So, although I wasn't with them literally, you know, when they started, they were in Chicago, and but they got together in order to further their musical ideas, you know, and have a reference and a point of contact from which to develop, you know, and nurture their musical selves, and also to that adage that in unity there is strength, you know, was also part of it. As a matter of fact, most organizations of the nature of the AACM, BAG or whatever, get together in order to sustain themselves. Rarely do they merely get together to exchange ideas, you know what I mean? Because most of the time, people that take a more, shall I say, unpredictable path in their work, you know, creative work, don't have the liberty of picking and choosing, you know, say, well, let's get together and form us a little group so that we can, you know, do this. Usually the other considerations, you know, enter into it. And at least for a while, you know, maybe it's better that we all work together and so that we can reinforce each other, you know.
So when do the group split up?
Oh, the ACM is not split up.
Oh, it's not split up?
No, no, no.
Okay.
It's still a Chicago-based group, to my knowledge, although many of the people are in New York and other parts of the country and the world, for that matter, but it's an ongoing organization.
If I'm not mistaken, members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago were part of that group at its inception?
Right, that's true. Let's see. I don't believe the percussionist Don Moyer. I don't believe he. In fact, I know that he wasn't a part of it at its inception, but he became a part of it. You know.
What made you move from Chicago to New York? Was that the next stop?
Made who move from there?
You. What?
No, no.
Why
no.
Did you decide
I lived in I lived in St. Louis.
Oh.
I never lived in Chicago.
Oh, I see.
I was there a few times, but I lived in St. Louis for a while. My reason for moving to New York was to find a broader base to develop from, you know, because the St. Louis community just didn't. There wasn't enough of it, you know. We had some great times there and stuff, but there wasn't enough of it so that the audience kept changing, you know.
There wasn't a big enough audience either?
Well, the thing is that numerically, kind of the same people, you know, I mean, it's kind of landlocked, so to speak. And the influences and the people aren't broad enough. You know, the inputs weren't sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
They were okay for a while, you know, but it just you know it became productive in a way. You know what I mean?
In New York now, I know you're doing multimedia shows. Can you give us a sense of the kinds of shows there?
Well, we've been working. As a matter of fact, one of the developments from our association with the Black Artist Group in St. Louis is our current interest and involvement with multimedia activities. And during the BAG period, we were able to work firsthand with people in other areas like sculptors, you know, painters, poets, writers, you know, dancers. So we learned a lot, you know. And there's nothing like being able to do that kind of thing over a period of time firsthand, you know, it's the greatest type workshop you can imagine, when you can make it sustain itself and happen over a period of time, you know. It educates one, you know, even though you may or may not, one may or may not have studied various disciplines. The points and important aspects, you know, you might not know the historical material and so forth, but you can. There are parallels in dance and music, and it enables, for example, between those two, the similarities and the similar considerations, ingredients, if you will provide, you know, a valid base for you to make decisions from concerning that medium, you know, a given medium. And so consequently we've been doing we made a movie in St. Louis, as a matter of fact. Filmmaking was a brief aspect of the Black Artist Group. We never had the resources to pursue it, and also we didn't have a member that was sufficiently into it, you know, to have the tools to work with on his own, as the musicians, for example, had their instruments, and the other people kind of brought their things. The people that were interested in film, and well, in film particularly, weren't far enough along to have acquired the proper tools, equipment, camera, so forth, you know. So even though we made this movie, we didn't do the technical work. We just we did the costuming and the whatever the sets where we conceived them. But anyway, what I'm getting to is that we utilize the movie in the mixed media things that we're doing now. For example, one of the things we did last spring, in May, we put on a program called the Coontown Bicentennial Memorial Service, right? And it was a program involving about seven musicians, singer Fontella Bass.
What real big hit back in the
Rescue Me?
Rescue Me, right?
The biggest one, yes. And let's see, a dancer. Let's see, Aku Kadogo, who's in a hit play in New York now. Let's see, Malinke, who's an actor and a director, but functioning as an actor in this situation. It was similar to a, the setting was similar to a weekend, in that we had a Saturday night kind of dance, roadhouse type thing, and the musicians were on the stage, and they went through this sort of metamorphosis, you know, stylistically, not costume-wise or anything. But, and then they became the choir for this church sequence, you know, with it was radio, Sunday morning radio type church, and Fontella was running these arpeggios on the piano, you know, and hello out there in radio land this morning, you know how they do that. And so and we used the film in that in part, so we had music, film, dialogue, dance. We took up a collection, right? You know? Then, let's see, recently, that was last summer, so we got that show together, you know, and we sort of have it in our repertoire, and we some other time we'll put that on, but you were about to say something?
Yeah, I want to know if you conceived of most of this, or if it's a kind of, you know, group input into what the final piece is going to be like.
No, well, I put it together, you know, along with Bakita. E.J. Carroll wrote the music and staged it, you know, and performed in it.
Where'd you perform it?
At the Edison Theater at Washington University in St. Louis. Let me tell you, the most recent thing we did on Mother's Day in New York, right, was a funeral service, right? It was called Who Do Done It? And this man was unable to participate in his funeral because he was caught up in red tape. So we staged at the Harlem Performance Center, and again we used film, band, participating on the stage, playing music, being part of the people on there, you know what I mean? And I won't go into detail, but the kind of thing, you know, we didn't use dance in that one, but that's the kind of thing we've been doing, you know.
Is one side of your album on Aristo Kunbidness part of the sound of a multimedia show? I wasn't sure. It kind of suggested that somehow in the liner notes, but
no. No, it isn't. Mm-hmm. I don't know quite what reference you're speaking of.
Well, if it's not true, it's not a
But movie. No, it isn't. Some of them, usually in that context, the music doesn't go on. There are spaces, you know, where they're really more visual than oral. Mm-hmm. And there are spaces where nothing happens, but something is going on that could be seen,
right,
you know, but not necessarily heard. So it would require some pretty good editing, I would think, to
make an album of it.
To make an album of it. It could be done, of course, but it would require rather judicious editing, I think, you know.
If you're just tuning in now, by the way, you're listening to Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and I'm speaking with Julius Hemphill, who was in Philadelphia for a performance this weekend, Saturday evening, July 24th, at the Foxhole Cafe in West Philadelphia, St. Mary's Church, on about 38th and Locust Streets. And we're discussing his music, and we'll be talking in a few minutes about his upcoming concert. Your new album's on Arista Records, your newest album, anyways.
Right.
How did you get to Arista Records? How did they get to you?
Well, I was did some work with Lester Bowie and in New York for an album called Fast Last. And from that I met this guy, Michael.
Michael Cascuna, former Philadelphian.
Is that correct? Yeah. Talked to me about, you know, doing something here, and it came out for this company, and it came about. So he was the producer on this side, you know.
As producer, what was his role in the rendering of your music?
Well, the producer has a very interesting and varied kind of function. In ideally, you know, the producer knows a lot about music, you know, if not necessarily about the music you're dealing with, he knows things about music, period, you know, so that he'll know a bad start, you know, just technicalities like that, mm-hmm. let alone maybe some aesthetic kind of thing. But I think his first line of judgments concerning the technical aspects, and if those come over, are surmounted quickly and easily, you know, then probably his aesthetic sense comes into play, you know, and so you discuss things, you know, and sometimes if the performer isn't, you know, is thinking about something else, and so you have this kind of a third party, so to speak, or hopefully objective kind mm-hmm. of individual, you know, who's looking at the whole proceedings, you know what I mean, and serves as a go-between again between the engineer, in a lot of cases, and the performers who are outside in the studio, you know, and there's so many, you know, little, seemingly little but important things, you know, that that the producer does. It's like utility man, so to speak, you know, he's doing all these different things that need to be done, that occur, and things you might not overlook. You're preoccupied in one direction and you're missing something, you know, and you know, and he reminds you, you know, that you missed that. Oh, right, you know, and you go back or something, you know, but right. Usually some really important function, you know.
A lot of jazz record companies seem to be changing their image more towards highly saleable music, jazz fusion music, very electrified with a kind of dancing beat in the background. Do you think it's getting harder to record contemporary jazz, acoustic contemporary jazz, or even, you know, any kind of electrified but serious non-dancing, non-highly commercial jazz music?
I don't think it's getting any harder,
no.
For sure. I mean, it's been on the difficult side all along, so mm-hmm. I don't see it becoming any more difficult. I think it might be becoming more reasonable, you know, as opposed to more difficult.
Good, that's encouraging.
I hope it's, yes, okay. I hope that's the case. You know.
Clive Davis is the president of Arista Records, has a biography out now that he's written about his life with Columbia Records. I'm wondering if you've gotten to meet him through your recordings.
No, I never have.
Okay.
I've never seen him, I don't think.
Just wondering. Now, one side of this album was recorded in 1972.
Right.
Was that on tape but not put onto disc for a few years?
Yes, uh-huh. As a matter of fact,
That was the side that we were listening to before.
Yes, uh-huh. That was part of the session in which we recorded the album I brought today, which we produced independently back then in 72.
Right.
It's called Dogon AD.
And the label is called Mbari?
Mbari, yeah.
Mbari.
Mbari, yeah.
Okay, we'll be listening to some of that record in a couple of minutes. I'm speaking with Julius Hempel, jazz composer, arranger, alto saxophonist, and he's going to be performing at the Foxhill Cafe this coming Saturday, July 24th. Who are you going to be playing with?
Oh, great, thank you. Philip Wilson, percussionist. He's on the Arista Coon business, and he's also on the Dogon. Abdul Wadud, cellist, is on both of those also. And Olu Dara, trumpeter. So we'll have a quartet.
Okay. Let me just run through who else can be seen at the Foxhole this weekend? It's a festival of new black music. Friday evening, July 23rd, a Philadelphia-based jazz group called Rue. Saturday evening, July 24th, Julius Hempel and the people he just mentioned. Next coming Friday, July 30th, a group called Image. And Saturday, July 31st, Oliver Lake. There is an admission charge, which I cannot give on the air. There are two shows per night, 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock. The Foxhole is located at 3916 Locust Walk inside St. Mary's Church. And this is a number you can call for more information, 386-8388. Once again, that's 386-8388. Julius, we're going to be listening to a selection from your Dogon album, and can you tell us something about it before we hear it?
Okay, it's called Dogon AD, the AD representing adaptive dance. I was attempting to capture the spirit of kind of African dance movement that I saw once, and I came up with this little rhythmic figure that I employed in this.
Okay, can you just tell us who's featured with you on it?
Oh, sure. Bakita E.J. Carroll is on trumpet, Philip Wilson is on drums, and Abdul Wadud is on cello.
Okay, and we'll listen to that now. Julius Hempel, thank you very much for coming to WUHY today.
It's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Thank you.